I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Brew Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the Riptide. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Howdy, hey, howdy. Good to see y'all.
Palmer.
I wanted to ask Martin about the fish guts. How did they ever figure out to add isinglass to beer? Haven't you ever wondered that?
Well, no, a lot of the gut related things, like cheese and with rennet and
rennet, there's another one, yeah.
And, all these things, it's because it was a handy storage vessel. So a lot of times the bladders in animals are waterproof. For example, sealing up jars of preserves and things like that, they will take a pig's bladder and they'll stretch it out, and then they will stretch that over the top of the preserve, tie it off with some twine, and then when it dries to this nice tight seal over the jar. So they didn't have
saran wrap,
mason jars and stuff and saran wrap. Yeah, they had to cover the little pot with something, and they would use bladders. And so I could imagine somebody with, for example, they talk about using it as a bladder to hold. Or a stomach to hold a milk, and then seeing how it curdled, to make cheese. That's one way. Perhaps, the same thing happened with isinglass.
Beer into a fish and.
Right. Well, if I had beer
clarified.
And I didn't have any containers, I'd be just like, hey, kill that big fish over there. Let's take its swim bladder out. Let's pour it in there. I'd want to be taking some beer with me. I wouldn't want to travel very far back then, traveling to like the next city, that took some
walking. Took all day. Yeah.
It took a long time, or it may have taken weeks. And what am I going to do? Not drink for a week? It's not going to happen. So I'd be slaughtering every animal I could and filling up their guts with beer, and then, putting that into it, tying it off somewhere. And that's how I would survive. To the next city, because I'm not drinking the water back then. That water is nasty stuff. Who was probably the first person to do this would be to
drink the water. Yes,
would be a relative of slaughter an animal and start
pull out the bladder and fill it. Yeah, okay. That
would be our good friend John Blickman. One of his ancestors, because. I imagine he comes from a very long line of creative brewing related people.
Yes. Yes. What could I use this bladder for?
Right. Well, let me kill something and see what I can use all the pieces parts for. And so he was innovating your fish guts, or innovating your beer storage with fish guts back then. Now today he's innovating your brew day. He is creating great brewing equipment that makes your brew day more fun, more successful, and that includes if you're a pro brewer too. Blickman Engineering is producing, professional brew gear. And if you're looking at opening a brewery, or if you open a brewery and you're using a 15-gallon pot and brewing 12 times a day trying to supply your customers, well, I got news for you. Maybe you want to check out, a Blickman Engineering, brewery, and you can get up to a larger size brewery and make your brew day just that much easier. Same amount of labor brewing 10 gallons as it is 1,000 gallons. There's pretty much no difference between the two, except at the end you have 999 gallons more beer to serve.
So right,
check that out. If you get a chance, send an email, feedback@blickmanengineering.com, and tell him how much you appreciate that he is paying for the show so you do not have to. I think that's very kind of him to have done for the last 15 plus years. And so the least you owe him is an email saying thank you. Today, we were going to kind of tackle some of your brewing questions that you've sent us. You can send us questions by sending them to brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com, and we'll get those. And eventually, over time, sometimes it takes me 12 years, but I make sure that we get to all the questions. It just takes a little time sometimes, but the ones we have today are much more recent, and so recent that some of them from our last show about Porter, the history of Porter. Martin Cornell, a really great guy, was fascinating. I could just sit there and listen. Back.
Yeah, yeah.
Sit there and listen to him talk for hours. We got to have him back, like you're saying. Peter was asking, with high gravity beers of the times, is there a known degrees of modification and conversion? And with less modification, would more malt contribute to more flavor? I'm not sure I understand that question 100%, but yeah, they didn't have highly modified malt. Right. Part of the problem was the way that they were kilning the malt also reduced some of the ability of
the enzyme potential. Yeah,
and does less malt? I guess the question would be: does less modified malt contribute more malt flavor?
Not necessarily. When we talk about modification, we are talking about how much extract, soluble extract, comes out of the barley to become beer. It goes into the wort to become beer. So if you have less modified malt, it has lower extract. You end up using more malt to get the same amount of fermentables. You end up leaving that unmodified portion in the mash tun.
The starch that hasn't been modified.
Yeah, starch has been modified, proteins
solubilized.
All of that is insoluble and stays in the mash tun, so it doesn't go into the wort. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you can draw a quick correlation to less modified, more malty flavor. I don't think there's a relationship there.
I would think that there's a relationship possibly between, I agree with you 100% on that, that there's possibly a correlation between, when they were doing higher kilning of malt back right. then and had less control over it, maybe you're developing some more flavors,
Different flavors, more flavors, melanoidins, yes. And because... European brewing practice, decoction brewing, that was specifically to fix that less modified problem. Mm-hmm. And so the longer boil times, the decoctions, all of that resulted in a maltier flavor with the malts because they were boiling longer. They were getting more melanoidin formation. So mm-hmm. That is where there is a correlation, or at least a result of some maltier flavors from using a less modified malt, but it's due to the process that was used for, you know, extraction for the mash and for boiling, rather than saying, the malt itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, very interesting question, but I think we'd have to really dig into the details to give an accurate answer.
Well, the cool thing about listening live on Facebook is you can ask your questions there in the chat, in the comments section, and the lovely Miss Bevo is there, and she will pluck those questions and provide those to us, so you can ask live. Brendan was listening live, and he was asking, "Did the brewers actually have?" Referring back to our previous show about porters. Did the brewers actually have problems with brewing specifically too high of a mash pH? And how did they find that roasted barley reduced mash pH and made a better beer with their particular water? And what were people doing with water back then in the 18th century? Were they, the invention of the black patent would be, 19th century.
That's a very interesting topic. When I was researching the water book, that was one question I was wondering.
They would cite a brewery because there was
the good water
adequate
supply.
Water, right?
Yeah.
They would, Burton on Trent, water,
exactly.
The wells there. Near the Thames, there was a lot of
Burtonization of water was invented around 1850 or before 1825, somewhere in there in that period of time, way before pH, way before a lot of the chemistry that we know today that we take for granted. They had chemistry. And you can go back to some of the historic brewing texts you can find on Google Docs and stuff, where they're talking about measuring, how much calcium and carbonate, and they were using different terms, and I wanted to tell you that term, but I've forgotten. But I mean, they had ways of measuring these things, and they knew that these chemistries made better beer. They may have not known why, from say a pH point of view and so on, but they knew it was better.
Well, and so when was pH
1921.
Wow. Yeah. So, quite recent, 100 years.
Yeah.
We're coming up on the 100th anniversary of pH.
Yeah. They understood acidity and base, and acid base chemistry, but they didn't have
a measurement for it.
Right. They didn't have a measurement system or an instrument for it.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Let's see here. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more of your questions right after this.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Are you looking for a simple brewing system that's great for all grain brewing, but everything on the market seems to be full of compromises? Blickman Engineering has the answer. The Blickman Brew Easy All Grain Brewing System. The Brew Easy is a complete system with easy upgrades and a beautiful compact design, perfect for any size brewing location. At its core, the Brew Easy is built on two gorgeous Blickman Boilermaker brew kettles, a high temperature March pump, and either a top tier gas burner or the new Boil Coil electric heater. The Brew Easy adapter lid allows the pots to stack stack on top of each other, forming an efficient, strong, and compact brewing setup that comes in 5, 10, and 20-gallon batch sizes. Upgrade your BrewEasy system with full automated control by adding a Blickman Tower of Power temp controller, and make moving around easy with the Blickman Kettle Cart. The BrewEasy is modular. If you already own a Boilermaker kettle, you can build your BrewEasy by purchasing just the modules you need. The new BrewEasy all-grain brewing system. See it today at BlickmanEngineering.com and brew with Blickman quality on your new BrewEasy.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're doing a live Q&A session here, me and my dear buddy John Palmer, from the hop fields where he's at to the brewing office at Heretic. And one thing I like about this shot behind me, as I look at everybody else with all their fancy backgrounds, the thing I like about this is I've got the fan in the tap room is turning, and right. That so no matter, you know, you can see if I've died or I'm just sitting here thinking, but you can see that it's not frozen video.
Right.
It's still live. You see, if the fan stops turning, then it's probably,
or if you stop moving and the fan's still going, it's like, right. He is
pretending.
Dead.
I'm pretending that the video is frozen. So I don't have to answer the question. Let's see. Camillo is listening live as well. And he says, I have a question. What type of yeast did people use in the beginning to make porter? And did they measure the yeast that they were using? Did they, back in the 1700s, I guess, when it was London Brown, or was it? Oh, no, I think he said in the 17th century. So in the
1600s,
1650, let's say, end of 1600s. If it was London Brown, they didn't even really know about yeast then, did they?
Right. There was a really fascinating talk by one of the brewers at Guinness last week with the World Brewing Congress virtual conference. And I'm trying to remember when the microscope was invented. And I think that was like mid 1700s, 1750-ish. So that's when they started looking at yeast under the microscope. They didn't recognize it as a living organism that, you know, caused fermentation.
I thought it was just a byproduct, a waste product.
Yeah. And so it was Pasteur, among a few others, that defined this is what's going on in fermentation. How did that go? So anyway, back to the question. The yeast, what yeast did they use?
Brewing yeast.
Yeah. One of the things that the brewer from Guinness told us was that everybody borrowed yeast from everyone else.
Right.
So there was constant yeast sharing in a location.
Because you still see that today.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't know how to store it. So one of the anecdotes or history of the Guinness brewery was that he shut the brewery down for about 2 weeks to install a new steam engine. And in that time, their own yeast culture died or whatever. They immediately went out and around the area and got some more. And so what they had been using for Guinness Stout for, you know, a period of 20 years, 25 years, ended then. And then I think, I forget what year that was that we were talking about, 1760 perhaps, they started up with new local cultures from the area. And another aspect of that talk was that Irish yeast is its own group, fairly different from the
selective
British
pressure.
Selective pressure and also origin. The genomes are different enough that they gave it its own group versus British yeasts. And they think that the Irish yeasts are actually a hybrid of the British yeasts and American yeasts, surprisingly enough. So, yeah, great, really interesting talk.
I think the whole, you know, history of brewing is quite fascinating. And, and even, you know, when we look at, you know, what's going on today and a lot of the new discoveries and techniques and things, it's like, well, you know, if you didn't have the ability to measure pH until, you know, 100 years ago, I mean, you know, that we're just figuring out pH related things in beer today, it's not that surprising. Because, you know, it wasn't like you had the little portable meter 100 years ago. I'm sure it was, quite a bit.
Dissolved oxygen and Brett and, all those. So the whole origin of porter as far as a vat-aged beer, stale beer, meaning aged, and the Brett character that would eventually come out in that. Interesting to speculate on, you know, what that porter may have tasted like, what kind of Brett that was, and, you know, how, in given the very large size of these tons that they were using, you know, was it a pretty subtle Brett character? Fascinating to speculate.
Matt Clay wrote in. Again, you can send your questions in to brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com. And just like Matt, you will get your question asked. Hello, with the rise of electric brewing systems, I've been looking at the Anvil Foundry. I'm especially intrigued as I have an open 220-volt outlet in my kitchen from the electric stove that I replaced with a gas unit. I have a couple of questions. If I change the plug on the foundry, or any 220-volt compatible brew system for that matter, to the NEMA 6-15 or 6-20. And what that is the number, the first number is kind of like the, you know, style, and the second number is the amperage that it's able to, you know, so 6-15 is 15 amps and a 20 is a 20-amp plug. A 30 would be a 30 amp plug, and then they will have different kinds of configurations on them. They are all not just interchangeable to the outlet. You got to get the outlet and the plug to match. Let's see here. Should I be able to utilize the 220 volt outlet in the kitchen with a proper GFCI and or plug adapters? If in the summer I chose to brew outside, I only have 110 volt receptacle available. Got to use 110 to 220 step-up transformer to achieve 220 in this situation. Alternatively, if 110 volt is my only option and I switch the brewing unit back to 110 mode, are there adapters, assuming proper GFCI protection, that would allow conversion of the 615 or 620 plug now on the brewing unit for use on a 515 receptacle? The plug can be changed out. I mean, you can constantly swap out plugs for whatever plug you need. It's the extra line that you need for 220 versus 110. One of the things I think a lot of times people don't realize is that it's not that difficult for somebody to run, 220 to a location somewhere in your house. Because if you have 210 volt, circuits, on separate parts of the panel, you can pull, that voltage to another location. It's generally not too expensive and really does, you know, when it comes to heating, being able to run at the higher voltage, you do get more effective heating than on the 110.
That really is one of the real perks of the Anvil Foundry all-in-one, is that it, switching from 220 to 110 is just a switch on the side of the unit. I mean, it's covered, but you take the cover off, flip that, and then you can plug it into the appropriate power. I use, 220 when I can, but I also have one of the small ones myself, which allows, you know, a good vigorous boil on 110, and which is very convenient.
Well, and one thing I would suggest, Matt, checking out is RV supply places.
Yep.
For our British folks, the travel trailers, or what do they call them? The campers.
Caravans.
Yeah. Camper caravans. They will have adapters from 220 down to 110. And they're in short little, you know, whips that are maybe like 6 inches or a foot long. They're not too expensive. And so you would keep your 220 plug on one side, and then when you are hooking up the anvil for 110, you could plug in with the other one. So that might be a way to go.
Yeah. There's a Anvil Foundry user group on Facebook where they discuss these sorts of issues quite a bit. So you maybe find some real good recommendations there for specific adapters and so on that allow you to go back and forth easily.
Let's see here. Troy writes in with positive thoughts. Mr. Nice. Zanishev, I only stumbled upon Brew Strong as I was perusing the homebrewing Reddit page, and someone wrote something along the lines of, I'm looking for a brewing podcast that doesn't have crude humor. I like the Brew Strong podcast, but there are way too many dick jokes. Ah. That's feedback there, John.
Yeah, guilty as charged, yeah.
Of course, that piqued my interest. And to figure out who this Jamel guy was and how good were his beer-related dick jokes. Been listening for the last 3 or 4 months, and let me say I am not disappointed. Hope whatever medical stuff you are going through is going well. Sending positive thoughts your way. Looking forward to having you back on the podcast. Troy. Yes, Troy. I am the master of the brewing-related dick joke. I'm just saying. I don't think there's many out there better than me. Very, very proud of. Very proud of that. I did the Beersmith podcast with Brad.
Oh,
Brad's a very straight-laced guy, you know, and I'm sure he's told a joke or two before in his time, you know.
Oh, yes.
A fun guy. But he's, you know, determined to, you know, make sure his podcast is very clean and very straightforward. And he says, well, I just want to, you know, remind you. And I said, well, you don't have anything to worry about with me, because I'm a very quiet, straight, plain guy. I don't, you know, I'm not out making dick jokes all the time. It's the Brewing Network. It is just the Brewing Network. When I get with close friends and we're in private, maybe, but normally I'm not making dick jokes. So it is just the Brewing Network. And you all get to experience the joy of hearing us cut loose and have some fun. You know where I like to cut loose and have some fun is up at Brew Chatter up in Reno. They have a beautiful homebrew shop, all sorts of great ingredients, lots of fresh ingredients, lots of knowledge, lots of cool equipment, every little last thing you're looking for. Plus, they have a great bar in there. And they bring in a number of great commercial beers. They'll even have some Heretic on every once in a while. And I'll stop in there and I'll just sit down at the bar and start drinking while they're helping customers. And then I get to chat with customers and drink. It's just pretty much wonderful.
One question. I mean, given the fact that this is Reno or close by.
Yes.
Do they have other entertainment at the bar there?
I get where you are alluding to, sir. But
slot machines, yes.
That would be highly inappropriate. There are no slot machines. There's
good.
No other ancillary entertainment. I would think, you know, lots of homebrewing knowledge, lots of great beer. Lots of great people stopping in and saying hi. I think that alone is great reason enough to visit to Brew Chatter.
Indeed.
In Sparks, Nevada, right next to Reno. Or if you're on the web, check them out, brewchatter.com. Send them a nice email and say hi for us. Thank them for chipping in some bucks to keep this show going.
We do appreciate it.
There you go. All right. Another short break. And when we come back, more of your questions right after this.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're taking your questions live, and we are going through your questions that came in via email, which you can send to brewstrong at thebrewingnetwork.com. And we do get those, and we do read them. Sometimes it takes a little while to get to them, but we do them. Let's see. Sean wrote about, he's curious about diluting beer and there being an issue with calcium. He says, "Hi, I'm planning on diluting a beer with water and seem to remember some issue regarding calcium that I need to be aware of. But what was it? Does the water need more or less calcium than the beer has?"
Right. So when you're diluting beer with water, you're diluting that the calcium potential. In the case of the final beer, it's not a big deal.
Depends how much you're diluting it.
Yeah.
You know, 50%. Well, maybe you want to make sure there's some mineral component to your water.
Right.
10%, you know, you could use distilled. Not as much of an issue.
The thing about calcium, it doesn't have a flavor, but it has some aspect of mouthfeel. And with a lack of calcium, with high dilution, for example, you could get a watery tasting beer. I think a bigger issue, though, when it comes to diluting finished beer is the oxygen level in that water. Mm. And any oxygen that you add, you know, post-fermentation is going to contribute to the staling. Mm-hmm. So even if you were to boil the water vigorously for half an hour before you use that to add it, you know, add to the beer, you would only get down to like 1 to 2 parts per million of oxygen and no lower. And that's still enough to contribute to staling.
Yeah, it's huge. Bubble CO2 through it.
Yeah. That helps.
That's how
helps
we strip it out. That's how we scrub oxygen from our water that we use for any sort of dilution here.
There you go.
And that seems to help. So,
yeah,
I would imagine bubbling CO2 through water would also it might do something to the calcium as well. Does it have an effect on the calcium level?
Well, if it would depend on the specific chemistry, but if the pH went up high to 12. Mm-hmm. Then you would encourage the precipitation of calcium carbonate. Mm-hmm. But actually, when you're bubbling CO2 through the water,
yeah,
the pH will drop, and so it'll become slightly more acidic by about half a pH unit. So that shouldn't be an issue.
Okay. My dear friend, Dan Magnus, from Brewhouse 19 out in Sweden. Out of Karlsham, Sweden.
Yeah.
Fantastic brewer out there. He says, dear friends, love to watch your show. Getting late here in Sweden by now. He says, tomorrow we're brewing a hazy triple IPA. Wow. As we heard Martin tell about winter warmers, he says, do you want to share your fall winter favorite beer style?
Ah, mine's Oktoberfest.
Ooh, that's true. See, I thought I had an answer, and then you just come up with Oktoberfest. Mic drop. I'm like, I've been enjoying some Eyinger Oktoberfest.
Actually,
for our little Oktoberfest here, I bought Eyinger Oktoberfest, Eyinger Doppelbach, the Celebrator, Eyinger Maybach, and Eyinger Dunkel. And we bring in fresh. Oh, nothing like it. I can't tell you how much I love those beers. So yeah, an Oktoberfest is a good call. I was gonna say, well, you know, maybe for me, fall, winter, I'd have to go with like Evil Three.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Ah, now there's there's an easy drinker. That's
a delicious beer. Yeah,
and I can only get that once a year, so that's one of my favorites. Yeah, as far as, you know, style wise. I don't know. I think
I've never been that keen myself on winter warmers because with what is it about them? To me, they kind of go against my expectations. I mean, of a higher alcohol, but thinner. I don't know. But they're not like a double IPA where higher alcohol, a little lower body, and more hop bitterness. These are less hoppy, a little bit sweeter. I don't know. If I was going to brew a winter warmer, I think it would end up being more like a strong American brown ale. And again, I'm kind of going back to the Oktoberfest kind of thing because the fall, a little cooler temperatures, I'm looking for that maltier, heavier beer. You know, not necessarily sweeter, but just a little bigger and maltier.
There you go. Well, Don Magnus, I think I'm looking forward to hopefully trying your triple hazy IPA sometime.
Yeah.
If all you folks have it accessible in Sweden, you should make sure to try it. Check out the beers at Karlsham at Brewhouse 19. Brewhouse 19. How's that for my Swedish? Pretty bad, I know. Pretty bad, I know. But those guys, they still like me, I think.
It's a great country.
It is. Just wonderful people. Wonderful place. All right. David was asking, head retention in steins versus glass. He says, I've noticed that beer, when served in cups such as steins, have less head retention than the same beer served in glass. What could cause this difference? Could the glazing process affect nucleation sites within the vessel?
Could. It depends. You know, I think a rough surface would promote, you know,
more foaming.
More foaming, more nucleation of bubbles. You would lose more carbonation potential right away.
But you think you would build so much head that you would get, you know, maybe more head retention.
Well, but there's a difference between head formation and head retention.
Retention, true. So I wouldn't think it would affect head retention.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the diameter of the vessel, if your stein tends to be a larger diameter than the glasses you're using, that could affect head retention, I would think, just because of surface tension, you know, the changes and... so maybe that's a possibility. I would think which one is smoother some of these, glazing is the glazing, essentially, melted glass.
Yeah.
So I would think that that would not be an issue either. I would think that, you know, either diameter or, you know, the maybe it's just that you're assuming that this happens because you've seen it a couple of times and you really haven't done a detailed study of the glass.
I can't think of a chemical reason off the top of my head or a metallurgical reason between glaze and glass to cause a difference in head retention.
Right. And I, you know, one of the other things I can think of is temperature, you know, the thermal mass of something like a stein versus a glass. I could think of the diameter difference. I could think of, you know, potentially a height difference. Depends on what kind of glass we're talking about and what kind of
But stone. In terms of the things that are known to affect head retention, cleanliness is number one.
It's probably the greatest, yes. I
would agree. And so maybe there's a categorical difference or a typical difference in cleanliness between his stein and his glassware. I don't know. But usually cleanliness has a lot to do with head retention.
Right. Are you questioning the cleanliness of this man's stein?
I'm just suggesting that maybe his wife washes the glasses and he washes the steins. Mm. And somebody's doing a better job than the other, perhaps. Who can say?
Right. Maybe he's only whipping out his stein on Oktoberfest.
Yeah,
and he's getting his greasy sausage eaten fingers in his stein.
Yeah,
and
sausage grease on the mustache—that's a big head retention killer there.
Right, right. There you go. That's certainly a possibility as well. Let's see here. Travis wrote in. He says a different Travis. Travis Stout from Colorado Springs. He says, "Hello, I have a question about dumping yeast with a conical fermenter. I have a grandfather conical and it has a pretty small yeast dump port. They recommend doing a dump every 3 to 4 days to avoid clogging. I personally believe a morning dump is better every day, you know, first thing in the morning when I wake up, a morning dump, and that avoids my clogging. I am assuming there is not anything worth dumping until the croizon has fallen, which I'm guessing should be done after 5 to 6 days. My main question is, other than wasting beer, can you dump too early or too much? Can I assume everything that is needed for fermentation to acid rest would stay in solution and what I don't need would have fallen to the bottom? If you're just looking at dumping the yeast and not harvesting the yeast, there will be some that will drop early even while you're at high croizon. Because, you know, there are some dead cells that are always in there and, there'll be some tubes, some break material that'll be at the bottom as well. Yep. So you could dump that early. Yes, every time you dump, anything out of it, you are wasting some beer. The longer you wait and let everything kind of pack up tight at the bottom, you have less beer in there, but it won't go out through that small valve easily. You need the small valves, the small openings really only work when whatever you're passing through it is fairly loose and liquid. When it's nice and condensed and holds very little beer, it doesn't go very easy. This is one of the reasons I'm just not a fan of trying to dump off a bottom port on a conical, unless you can get something that's got, even with an inch and a half or 2 inch port, unless you've got some hydrostatic pressure behind it, or you can, you know, or pressurize the vessel.
Sharp V. Yeah.
It just won't push out. It'll just bridge across there. Cause I've got fermenters here. They're 22 feet tall. 22 and a half feet tall. And even then, you know, if you pack up a good, you let that yeast build up hard at the bottom, it really still doesn't want to come out. I mean, it can be a challenge sometimes. And that's, you know, with 2 inch ports. So you have to you know, expecting it to work on a conical, I think you got to go when it's loose. If you want to get that stuff out. What I always did with conicals was I just let it all form up at the bottom and then I just racked out of the top. That was my solution.
Yeah. I think if you want to do if you're going to do yeast harvesting from the conical, then yeah, do an early trub dump, first day, second day, mm-hmm. While that's the majority of what's down there, and then maybe let it go, as you say, 3 or 4 days before you mm-hmm. try taking some yeast out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and harvesting yeast can be relatively tricky because if you're harvesting early yeast only, the early yeast are ones that do not attenuate as well and they flocculate earlier. And what you're going to find is you'll get beer that clears really well, but it won't attenuate well. And it's going to be, and if you keep doing that, it's going to attenuate less and less and less. And, maybe that's the way you're going for. If you start, dumping all the rest of the yeast and then you wait for the very end to get the most attenuative yeast, you're also going to get the stuff that doesn't flocculate very well. So you'll start getting a yeast that remains in suspension and causes a haze, and it's very hard for it to flocculate. It'll attenuate well, but, won't flocculate. And that can happen in, just a generation or two, a couple times of doing it, all of a sudden you've kind of screwed up the yeast that you were trying to harvest. So it depends on what you're trying to do. I mean, sometimes it's just cool to mess around and select different yeasts and, just make a yeast start acting kind of weird, doing different things. And you'll get different flavors as well. So you just have to kind of be a little bit careful about what you're doing there, harvest wise. Let's see here. I think I got time for one more. KJ writes in, I have been homebrewing around 9 years. I searched for specific topics in Brew Strong over the years. I just recently started a job, hour commute. Decided to go back to the first topic ever, make my way through the majority of the list. This has led me to a few questions. Through experimentation, I found that adding things to fermenters post hycroisin achieves a brighter, more fresh flavor. I'm somewhat of a fanatic about sanitization, and I've done some pre-packaged things like canned fruit and candy syrup straight from the package with good results. I've also done a vodka tincture with things like spices, cocoa nibs, orange peel, and vanilla beans. I'm curious of other methods of adding things to a fermenter in a sanitary way, more specifically dry items that clump up and would require stirring, like PB2 powder, graham cracker crumbs, and he's interested in trying a powdered cream cheese. I'm not so sure powdered cream cheese is a good idea for beer.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but it could be something nasty. Also, fresh fruit, although I'm considering Jamel's suggestion of fruit puree for wine. The Oregon fruit purees. And there's other aseptic fruit purees that are pretty good. Thank you for the help and the education over the years. Thank you for any help you give me now. So, John, what do you do if you're trying to add things to a fermenter?
Yeah, I think adding them, well, there's the hot side and cold side. So if you add them to the hot side, to the whirlpool step, if you will, after the end of the boil, where it's still hot, you can add some spices there. You don't want to boil them in general. But that's a good way to get good extraction of the essence into the wort. And you get a lot of flavor from hot extraction. Whereas if you go cold side after hycroisin to preserve more of the aroma, cold side additions tend to have more of the spice or that character aroma. Than flavor. Flavor is usually diminished because of the longer contact time. it's kind of like the difference between hot brew and cold brew coffee, mm-hmm. you know, or in other spices that I find.
Right. I'm of, two minds of this. One is, you don't want to, introduce any sort of microbiological contamination into your beer and cause your beer to go sour or something like that. But, if you are home brewing it and you're going to keep it in a, let's say, a keg cold in your fridge, then, that's not such a big deal. The pace at which that would become an issue, you probably are going to consume the keg, long before that happens. You can store it for a good month with a pretty high bacterial load and still not see hardly anything happen. So on the one hand, I would be, don't worry about it. Just toss it in there. When I did, some stuff, in the home brewing, I would worry about it more. But what I've kind of discovered is that a lot of times there isn't anything in some of these powders. Depends on how the powder is made, of course. But one of the things you can always do is, heat it up in an oven. That takes a little bit more heat. Mix it with a small amount of hot water, or mix it with a little bit of hot water, and then you can heat that up. And if you can get that up to 140 degrees for half an hour, it'll be pasteurized. Versus, powder in like an oven where you have to get it up to 350 degrees, 300 degrees.
Yeah.
When it's wet, it takes far less heat. So, you get up to 161 degrees Fahrenheit and it's pretty much instantaneously pasteurized at that point, which is a fairly low temperature for, changing the aromatics and the brightness of something. The higher you temperature you put something to, the more it changes it and you get more of that cooked character.
Yeah.
Does extract more. So, if you're really concerned about it, I would look at, possibly trying the mixing with water and then just warming it up to a pasteurization temperature. Mm-hmm. He's already mentions using alcohol for a tincture, things like that.
Yeah.
And then, there are products out there that are already done that way. So, I stopped adding things to the boil, except we're making a beer called Monster Cookie now that has actual chocolate chip cookies in it. And those we throw into the boil. <'Cause>, I don't know.
Yeah. Chocolate seems to survive boiling pretty well.
Yeah. It's all the chocolate chip cookie flavor does too. It's pretty shocking how well it goes through. Let's see here. Scott asks, hello, I'm hoping you answer a quick question I have about calculating my mash efficiency. On the malt analysis sheet, two extract percentages are listed, fine grind and fine grind dry. Do I use the as is fine grind or do I use the dry malt grind when I compare my percent of efficiency?
Generally use the fine grind dry basis as the absolute. And that, and you're calculating this. I discussed this in How to Brew in the What to Expect When You're Extracting chapter. I forget what chapter number it is. It's like 18 or something. But that's your that's your laboratory maximum. And then from there you say, you take that percentage. It's usually around 81 or 82% total soluble extract. Multiply that against the 46 points per pound per gallon for sucrose. That gets you to 32 points per pound per gallon. That would be the absolute maximum extraction you could expect from the malt. And then from there, you take 75% of that as your brewing efficiency. And that would knock you down to say like 28 points per pound per gallon. And that's what you could typically expect for your brewing efficiency.
One of the main uses for that number is really in comparing malts. So it's there to provide a consistent method for analyzing malt. And when you want to look at one malt or another malt, somebody was offering me a different base malt here, and they're like, oh, you're going to save a ton of money. And I looked at it and I'm like, well, first, I'm really happy with the base malt we have. I like this flavor, so I'm not going to change based off of that. But, you know, one of the things to look at is, the potential extract that you can get out of it. And it was so much lower that it ate up any cost savings that would happen, and it would limit the amount of how high a gravity of beer I could brew. Because if you max out your mash tun and you're getting a lower extract, then your potential is dropped. So
yeah,
I thought that was something to be
careful. The one other point he asked was the fine grind as is versus the fine grind dry basis, how much moisture is in that malt. Mm-hmm. And on a homebrew scale, not really a big deal. I mean, even if it's, beyond the usual 4% moisture, on a homebrew scale, it's not a big deal. But a commercial scale, when you're using, thousands of pounds of malt, that equates to 20 pounds of water, to say, for example, more that you're putting into your mash tun, and mm-hmm. That's money.
Yep, makes a big difference. Bill asks, I would love to hear Jamel and John talk about mash thickness and why you would want to use a thinner or thicker mash.
Let's start off with the enzymes. There's talk about thicker mash is more gentler on the enzymes. You get longer enzyme half-life, or they don't denature as quickly under a thick mash than they do in a thin mash. But that's a very small factor compared to temperature overall and pH. Mash thickness is way down the list as far as things that really enhance the amount of extract you're going to get. So I don't think mash thickness is a big player when it comes to efficiency. That being said, a thicker mash will yield a higher gravity wort than a thin mash. And that's just the amount of water per grain, your water to grist ratio. That's what drives that. So, if you are brewing, low gravity beers, by that I mean like a 1040 to 1060, then a water to grist ratio of 4 to 1, 4 liters per kilogram or 2 quarts per pound is very reasonable. You'll get a good wort strength out of it. You don't have to boil an excessively long period of time to get to your target gravity. The mash moves very easily, which can be important for commercial installations where you're having to pump the mash to the lauter tun. Mm-hmm. A thick mash can help, on the other hand, can help you better hit a high gravity beer target and save you, time that way. What would you say, Jamel?
Yeah, I'd say just in general, it's not as important as, we used to think. I mean, it makes small differences in attenuation, fermentability of the wort. It changes, the ability of the mash to convert. There's too thin and too thick will impact your conversion ability.
Those are way out there.
Right, exactly. And like you said, it's more important in almost like a mash handling aspect where, if you're pumping it or stirring it or, you have volume restrictions on your vessels, that's probably the more important. And, if you're trying to hit a certain, high gravity runoff initially, I mean, that's, but that, again, that can be you know, countered with other techniques as well. So it's not really as important as, you know, I chalk it up more to convenience. And, you know, I would just keep the same mash ratio of water to grist at all times, unless you have some reason to changing it. And that way, as you're brewing, you're repeating the same thing. You're keeping one thing standard. You're not changing, you know, every time you brew, if you're changing your water to grist ratio, you know, you start messing with your ability to master all the process. And, you know, I like to simplify things and, you know, just keep them steady. And then once you've mastered everything else, if you want to come back and start messing with the amount of water in your mash, then you can start to see what difference it truly has. So, yeah, I don't think it's huge. But those are the reasons why, maybe you would change your mash thickness. But, like John says, you know, pretty much, you know, getting enough liquid in, you know, to cover like a probe, if you're making a small beer and, you know, you don't have a whole lot, it can be really low and you could be, you know, below whatever probe you might have, you know, that can be an issue. So you'd add more water, you know, thin it out that way. And that's also why I believe if you're making a small beer, you should be making like double batch, 10 gallons instead of 5. If you're making a big beer, you should be making, you know, it's actually the opposite. I always believed that's why people will do, you know, 10 gallons of small beer and 5 of a big beer. But really you want the opposite, because a small beer, it really isn't very durable, and you want to only make 5 gallons of that. So it can be consumed quickly and then brewed again. And a big beer, something like a Doppelbock or something, you know, barley wine, something like that, you want to make 10 gallons because, you know, you, it's something that ages over time and that you can enjoy over time. So, and you want to see how it changes over time. So that's why it's kind of the opposite of what the setup is. You want a large volume of big beer and you want a small volume of small beer. So need two different brew vessels, I think. That's the way it goes. All right. Another excellent pair of shows, my friend.
Thank you.
What can I say? Couldn't have done it without you, and couldn't have done it without our fine sponsors, Blickman Engineering, BlickmanEngineering.com, and Brew Chatter, BrewChatter.com. Check those fine folks out. Let them know that you love the show, and for them to keep on writing the checks. I've never seen one of those checks, but I imagine Justin gets them and does.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's been saving it up for us for you know, our, maybe
that's right.
A big 401k. Surprise.
Yeah.
He's probably been investing it for us, and you know, maybe 20, 30 years from now, he'll come out with this massive, you know, amount of money, and I'm just like, here you go.
Yeah,
he'll be like, yeah, see, all this wasn't for nothing, huh?
Can't wait.
Till then, everybody, brew strong.
Brew strong, everyone.